Good afternoon. My name is Linda Landergan. I'm the editor-in-chief of Academic Tracks Mystery Magazine, and welcome everyone to Jumping Jack Flash, the our panel on short mystery and crime fiction. Our panelists today are all advocates of short stories. They've also all written for the blog Criminal Brief, the mystery short story web blog project, which was started just, I think, under a year ago by James Wilson Warren. So I'm going to introduce the panelists, and I'll then turn the panel over to questions, and then we'll take questions for the audience. At the end is Angela Zeman.
Hello.
She's the author of the novel The Witch and the Borscht Quill. She's also published stories in my magazine, After Hitchcock. She has stories in the upcoming anthologies On a Raven's Wing and The Prosecution Mess. Next to Angela is James Wickham Warren. He's published stories in my magazine, After Hitchcock, and also in Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine. He's a weekly contributor to Criminal Brief with the column The Triplets. Next to Jim is Steve Feinbach, who writes the Bandersnatch's column The Criminal Brief. He's also written numerous articles and book reviews for Ellery Queen and for other magazines and mystery-related periodicals. Is this better?
Linda? Yeah, we're right next to you.
Here we go.
Thank God.
There's a uranium deposit over there.
Sorry about that.
Much better.
I'll start with Steve. Steve writes the Bandersnatch's column for Criminal Brief. He's published numerous mystery reviews and articles in other Queen and other mystery-related periodicals. In addition, he's published books on Judaism, religion, spirituality, and is the founding director of the Community Jewish Education Network of Southern Maine. And to my right is Lee London, who writes the ABD Detective column for Criminal Brief. His first short story for Ellery Queen, his first novel short story, won a Reader's Award in 2007. He has published stories also in our magazine. Melody Johnson Howe is writes the weekly blog for Criminal Brief. Oh, how you don't you? She's also the author of The Mother's Shadow and Beauty Guide, and her short story has appeared in Ellery Queen, and she's also a successful career comedian. And the star is John Boy, whose short stories have appeared in The Strand, Women's World, and Dr. Hitchcock. Among other publications, he has a collection of short stories called Raven's Rainbow Inn that was published in 2006. And his second book, Midnight, was released yesterday, 2 days ago. And he writes a column for Criminal Brief called Mississippi Mud. So welcome, everybody. Thank you.
Thank you.
To start the conversation off, I asked everyone to start to think about a short story that they would hold up as a model for just a well-written short story, short crime story. So, whoever feels comfortable answering first. Jen?
The first story I chose for that was The Adventure of the Red-Headed League by Arthur Conan Doyle, because it has several elements that I really love about Holmes in particular and crime fiction in general. And then discussing with Lee, found that Lee had picked that story. So I said, okay, I'll pick another story. And then the story I picked was Red Wind by Raymond Chandler, which is a story that I love not only because of Marlowe in general, but mystery fiction in general. And I talked to Melody, and she said, well, I pick Red Wind. So I didn't pick Red Wind, and I said, okay, well, I'll pick something else. And I'm not going to pick something else. But I will say that I think that they will have their own taste to take or own things to say on those stories when they discuss them. But getting back to the Red-Headed League, the first thing I really love about that story is it starts with something really bizarre. It seems completely irrational. And that is we have Jabez Wilson, who is hired for Pound a Week to copy out the Encyclopedia Britannica. And it's completely irrational. That's one of the elements I love in a mystery story. It turns out, of course, to have a perfectly rational explanation in the end. But the idea of having this bizarre twist at the beginning is something I always look for in a mystery story, and something I try to do in my own fiction when I write it. You know, they say that the most important part of the story for the writer is the most important part is the first sentence and the last sentence. I don't know if I really subscribe to that, but certainly getting the reader's attention is the first thing that any story should do. And in a mystery story, having that unexplained, something that is obviously unexplained, I think is the best way to do that. Red Wind, the only thing I have to say about that is I live in Southern California, and the story begins with a description of the Santa Ana winds. The wonderful thing about that is I speak from personal experience when I say that when you have a Santa Ana wind coming in and blowing through Los Angeles, it makes everybody crazy. It really does. And the story begins with that premise. The interesting thing about that story is the wind disappears almost right away after it starts, and the rest of the story takes over. But, well, Melody, you can have your own say. But that's another example of something that I think is fundamental and worthy of all emulation with regard to crime fiction.
You're meaning to come? Okay. A Catholic priest wearing plain clothes walked down the street and built that fire one. And a gunman jumped out and stuck a gun in his bag. He says, are you Catholic or are you Protestant? And the priest is like, oh man, if I tell him I'm Catholic and he's Protestant, he'll shoot me. But if I tell him I'm Protestant, I mean, no, I'm confused. If I tell my Protestant I'm Catholic, he'll shoot me. Or if I tell him I'm Catholic and he's Protestant, he'll shoot me. What do I say? Then he finally thinks of the perfect answer. I'm Jewish. And the gunman says, ah, oh, well, thanks in the Lord, I'm the luckiest Arab in Belfast. All right. That's not. I call short stories short fiction, which I know some other people on this panel do. And I think the reason is because fiction is fiction. You know, that was a funny story, and I hope nobody was offended because I was told the story by Emerald Sr., so I figured it was okay. And, but it's seven sentences, all right? Seven sentences. And in the seven sentences, there's religion, backstory, history. You have to know about the IRA and the troubles in Ireland. You have to know about the Israelis versus the Arabs. All of that is in seven sentences. And then on top of that, you have to emphasize when the situation, having a gun in your back, of course you know that's scary. But the question the gunman asked, do you know from your history that that is a question that came that you killed? And so it's a heightened stakes. And I think that's what the thing is with this short story. Each word is so packed and loaded because you don't have space. You don't have space to explain it all. So it's to me, that's what short story exemplifies and short fiction. And the, of course, the bigger your form, which up into novel and 700-page novels, you know, you can go all over the place. But that's why I really admire short fiction. That's why I wouldn't tell you what it was.
Sure. I haven't really picked one yet. I had a hard time choosing a story, particularly because I didn't know about the question until about 20 minutes ago. But the mention of Red Wind brought to mind another Raymond Chandler story, and that's Killer in the Rain. And that stands out for me because it's evocative. There's something about the scene and the setting that I can't get out of my mind. But I have to go along with Jim that what I look for in a model story is a great beginning and a great ending. And most stories have one or the other, or unfortunately, neither. For a great beginning, but you know, the most recent Ed Hoch book, the final one that was published in the December Ellery Queen, starts out with, well, it's such a bizarre situation, I can't even say it without spoiling it, so I won't just pick up the magazine. It's not this issue, but it's the next one after that. It starts with an impossible situation. I'll tell you a little bit. Someone being murdered twice, and then showing up again. And whatever the most recent short story by Lawrence Block that I read, that stands out for me as something with a great ending.
As James mentioned, rapidly changed mind, and he also gave a very good description of it. It's almost perfect because this mystery is crying, and the reader's puzzled, like, what is going on? And Sherlock sets out to solve that. And I'm not one for fine fiction, the ultra short stories. But there's one that's attributed to Frank Zappa. And the story was about a big bomb and a little bitty bullet. And the big bomb said to the little bitty bullet, "Don't you aspire to be a big bomb like me?" And the little bitty bullet said, "No, I like the first small touch."
I'm going to follow that. As poor Jane said, I like to live at Lynn, and for similar reasons. I lived in Los Angeles. I was a young woman beginning to read mystery fiction, and I read the opening paragraph of Red Wind and said, "I'm going to write like that." And one of the great lines in the opening paragraph is, well, he's describing the Santa Ana winds, and that they make people jumpy, so jumpy in fact, that the meek wife can feel the hard edge of the knife and stare at the back of her husband's neck. And that just has mood, tone, atmosphere, you know something's going to happen. Just all of that first paragraph by describing that wind. Also, throughout the short story, Chandler just sort of piles dead bodies. You think, how is he going to, explain all this? And in Frank Chandler's way, he does. He is great at explaining this without stopping the story dead. And in this is Chase for Pearl Necklace. And of course, if you want to call that story or the other story that's in the story by Pearl Necklace, the pearl is rusted and given to this woman by her real lover. But even her real lover turns out to be a jerk. So, and at the end, Marlowe, when he goes through this whole bloody caper, is left with this paste necklace. And he goes down to the ocean, trips on a rock, and you can just see him. He's got this suit hat, and I've got a gun on him. And he begins to throw his pearls into the ocean. And that is the end of the story. And it says so much about Marlowe. And that was just one of those stories. And I said, this is it. This is a guy who knows what he's doing.
This is short story. It should start with action. This would start with a violent action. I chose a man from the South. Lowell Dahl was a man from the South. If you all have not read that, it You might say in a TV adaptation for how he got presents back in the late 50s. But I love that story. It, it's a great build-up of suspense. It not only has a good twist ending, it has surprises and reversals throughout the story. I think it's really something. But the great thing about it, the odd thing about that story is that it's a mystery story, but it's not a crime story. No crime is committed. A lot of deception and suspense, but not really a crime. And when I saw the TV, Bill Alfred Hitchcock Presents version of that story, they put in an extra twist at the very end of the women's story, and I thought that was kind of different to it. And they made it even better.
One of the reasons why I wanted to start with the question is to start talking about the elements of a story that made a short story work for you. So I wondered if maybe you could answer your question of if there are four elements that maybe you didn't touch on while we were talking about the story. And when you're writing, if you keep these in mind, or in the back of your mind, or in the forefront of your mind as you're composing.
Twist in stories. And one of our fellow members of Critical Brief, Rob, has a story in Alfred Hitchcock that has nothing to do with it. It's a cover story. And usually I see the cover of this one, I didn't see cover at all. But I think that is one of the main elements.
The paradigm for a story is usually you have some kind of exposition, then you have a point of conflict that engages the hero, you increase the tension until you get to a point of unsustainable climax, and then you have resolution, and that's the basic arc of a story. Crime fiction is interesting technically from several points of view. One of them is because there are two internal conflicts instead of being just one from the very beginning. First of all, there is the solution of the crime, and that's usually what we think of when we think of detective fiction. But also there's the commission of the crime, which is a separate story. So in some ways, what you have in a detective story is one story that is actually explaining a different story at the same time. That makes it really interesting and writing short fiction very challenging because you are dealing with essentially two virtually different plots at the same time, and you have only so much space to put it into. I heard a lot of people once tell me that short stories don't have red herrings, and that's absolutely not true. You do have to deceive the reader in order to achieve that resolution. But one of the things that a short story really requires is an utter economy of words, as Angela was pointing out. And by economy, I don't mean as few words as possible, but I mean each word has to mean as much as possible. In other words, the most economical way to tell a story isn't the shortest way to get the facts across, it's the best way to get the story across.
You just stole my punch. I was going to nose up to the microphone and just say, economy.
I think a couple people mentioned embodiedness as something they like in the story, and I think that's part of that economy.
I was going to say also, I think pace is very important. And pace is something that's sort of like you either have a rhythm or you don't. Kind of thing. You have to understand the case. And that's what keeps the short story moving. You have to know how to edit the words. So as James was saying, that the important words are there. The ones that are just filling up the pages, take them out. Take them out. And a pace gives a certain rhythm to the story. And I think also, again, characterization for me is very important. I mean, you just write the short stories when you get by without characterization. And I write in a first-person narrative. I write short stories for everything with the same character, middle-aged actress named Diane Poole, and it's from her point of view. And so even the tone of her voice has a pace, has a rhythm to it. And Fitzgerald was great at this in the Pat Hogan short stories. A great example of that.
I agree with everything that Oh, you say. Nothing. No, I think the name is right. I think you have to have more big suspense, more surprise, and like we said, more versions. But the thing is, you don't have to have so much in crime fiction as other fiction, or things like new knowledge or sophistication of language, or something change. But even so, when you have those, it makes it even better when you think of people like James Lee Burke and others who can make a mystery story, a literary story, a mystery deliver a LA combination of some of those.
Do you have a conflict with friends when it comes to playing your writing? Well, these experiences that can influence when you play out your writing.
Can I comment on that? Because it's recent life experience. I have a story coming out in with the rare scenes. The Prosecution Rest, the anthology for MWA is coming out in the spring. So they had a real editor. And the editor, there's a difference, you know. In editor, she said, I had written the story in 2006. And at the time I wrote, it was seriously in-depth researched. And I was upset about home security taking away our personal rights. So I put that in the story. And so basically, you know, you could say it is from personal experience. This editor's from the West Coast. And distinguished lady, too. Of course, she nailed me going there on some stuff. But one of the things that I thought was interesting is when I said something about Homeland Security didn't need a warrant for this, I could do that. And then she goes, is this true? Are you sure this is true? And I'm like, yeah, at least I know that it was true when I wrote that. And I don't know what her response was to that, because I haven't heard that. But I would say, in that case, it was a life experience, definitely. It was my outrage at the stuff that was happening, and like, you know how you think, oh, I don't want to give up that right, and yet maybe I need to, and it's like very conflicting. But I put it all in that story, and I guess possibly she wasn't so on the spot as I was, and therefore unaware. And plus the dating of the story is 2006. Maybe they changed things since then. I don't know, because I stopped researching after I wrote the story. So I don't know. But I don't know if that's exactly what your question asked, but that was definitely a life experience that influenced my story. I don't usually get political in any story. So.
Well, I came from my family is very formal storytellers, and I was raised in Central Indiana, and I was raised on a farm that had been in our family six generations. And Edgar Jackson had signed in the original Langford Williams cemeteries with ancestors going back a century and a half, and tombstones with Civil War veterans on it. And a ferry ring of boulders that had been ripped from the fields, and boulders, you know, the size of people, my mother and her mother had tea parties and read and told stories, and we had ghosts in the house. And the area was wonderful for storytelling. There's a tiny legend actually, but an Indian legend about fire bear. And this fire bear was that night power. And there is a real solution for the fire bear that was discovered. It lives in caves in Flat Rock, Indiana, that had phosphorus. And it would glow in the night. So these stories strongly influenced me.
Well, I live in Athens back in the 60s and 70s, and that is really actually the thing that I write about in one way or another. The series of short stories that I write are about a middle-aged actress called Diana Poole. But I really write about not the movie stars acting as the everyday actress, the working actress, coming to make it. And actually, I got the idea from the Pat Hoppe story. I just, you know, instead of a screenwriter trying to get on the lot, you know, I made it an actress. But I think also with that background, I was thinking about, I learned from being an actress, I learned a lot about dialogue. And how dialogue can just die in your mouth. I mean, if it's bad, it's bad. I don't care, you know. I had a line once. The line was, it's in the silver chalice. And I just said, it isn't in the silver chalice. It's in the silver chalice. I got that line for some reason. Not a terrible line, but it just lay there. And it's hard to say, you know, especially the silver chalice in Latinx. And so I learned about dialogue and what to leave in and what to leave out. And the dialogue really is an art. It's not, you know, it doesn't have to be natural, but it has to sound natural. And there's a difference there.
What
if that was a Run For Your Life TV show with Ben Gazzara?
Oh,
yeah. I guess when I first heard this question, I thought, all of my experiences that I've had in transferred ships, when I pictured it all, I worked for IBM for 30 years, I traveled a lot, in the Air Force, and so I visited cities and countries that I guess showed up maybe later in my stories. But probably more than that, I grew up and still live in the Deep South, which is, I'm sure, considered a foreign country by most of the rest of the nation, and that's probably effective. It probably has effective.
In my case, my detectives are intellectually brilliant. No, really, my primary detective is an 18th century detective of the 1770s and 1780s. And in fact, I designed him backwards. And he and I virtually have nothing in common aside from the fact that we both have a tendency towards pedantry and to sometimes say things or go on and go on and go on about things that we're interested, whether anybody else is interested or not. But I think the point of life experience is whether or not the situations are credible and your characters are sympathetic. You can't write about that unless you have an understanding of what basic human motivations are. So I think every story of any interest is ultimately informed by your own experiences.
As I was growing up, my mother and her mother would always be at each other's throats. And the kinds of arguments that they would have, the things about my grandmother that grated on my mother, stand out for me so strongly that I've been toying with I was toying with the characters for a while, and pretty soon I discovered my grandmother doing things she never really did in her life. So out of that particular relationship evolved a couple of characters who I think turn out to be fairly real.
I think that the experience can give you some sort of passion for what you're writing, but then you have to pull back a little bit and let the story kind of take over.
My youngest daughter, I don't know where that's coming from, my youngest daughter is helping me with research. On a book I'm working on right now, and she's a very numbers type person. She's more like my husband Barry, and this is all new and fun to her. And then she just sent me an email and just, you know, she says, "How do you write a story?" And I'm like, "Oh, I mean, do you have a year of your life? I'll tell you." And the thing is, I knew I'd lose her interest if I didn't make it extremely short. So after kind of, you know, mulling around, I decided, well, you write, this is what I told her, you pick a subject and you pick it from your heart, you know, passion, you care, and it's like it inspires you and you have a lot to say and everything. Then you switch over to your mind and you examine your idea and you say, well, is anybody but me going to be interested in this? You know, is this going to be, is this going to work? And, you know, so this, then you switch back, and you, if you say yes, or after you tweak it a little bit, then you say yes, it's ready now, it's a story, then you sit down and you write, but you write with passion and your heart and your, all that. And then when you're through writing, you go back and you check it out again and just whack and cut and rearrange and everything because you're coming from your heart, your mind. And she goes, oh, I get it. She says, heart, mind, heart, mind. And I'm like, yeah, actually, that's right. And that's, I think that, to me, is the way to do it.
You all get involved with criminal grief, and most of you have been writing for just about a year now, regularly, to this. So I wonder, if you came to the line with something that you wanted to accomplish, and so what were your expectations of it?
Well, ask Chip. He's the father of it.
Actually, Criminal Grief had its first anniversary last April, so we're now like a year and a half. Oh. But the idea was, I wanted to have a rotating series of essays by people who knew what they were talking about and cared deeply about short stories to serve the purpose of as an advocacy site for short mystery fiction. I'd seen this work with other blogs. I'm sure most of you are familiar perhaps with Murder Rocket. You've seen that on the internet. That was put together by friends of mine. It's actually nominated for an Anthony here, that particular blog. But that way that works is that each person who contributes to it has a different day of the week where they choose some aspect about writing to describe with the world at large, and I wanted to do that for short fiction. So I then invited everybody here at some point or another to have one of those slots, and I'm very, very proud of it, I have to say. I'm very, very pleased and in awe of my fellow contributors who all think completely differently than I do and all have a lot of brilliant observations and things. I learn as much as I can from what they have to say. But as far as how it has affected my writing, it's probably taken up a little too much time. I probably should be writing some more fiction and less blogging.
As far as what purpose, you know, what motivated me to take part in it, just to have fun. It's a good group of people that both the bloggers and the people who comment on the blog. And what it's done for me is, well, as James will testify, I'm an 11th hour columnist, so it's forced me to write under pressure at the very last minute.
You never know. Your
columns
are very well written.
Thank you. I'm the newest writer, and frankly, in terms of the truth, and it's making me a much better writer, maybe a better, tighter writer. And Melody accused me of being controversial, and I don't understand that. I'm not worrying about technology or politics.
You tend to worry about technology and the brain sexing.
That's good. And sex, okay, yes, that's good. And I had the, I think, three calls in a row where I told little. What struck me at the time, little gems from writers, John Lewis and Paul Wilson, Susan Slater, better than that. And just wonderful little bits of phraseology that really struck me at the time. And these things have come together, I think, to really help me.
I actually love writing for the blog, and I really didn't think I would. And it's allowed me to write about things I would not normally write about. I'm probably one of the few here on the panel that really doesn't write about writing. 2 weeks ago, I wrote about my ass. They never stop kidding me about that. So I write about things that happen in my daily life. I write about my husband. And I keep saying to James, you know, I'm not writing about writing. I said, how much can you say about writing? And I think I can, you know, but I don't have that in my head. You know, so he's very kind and keeps saying to me, oh, but Melanie, quit your writing, really is a short story. So I just keep going. And I do it every Monday, and I've got very, I think, what takes me about 2 to 3 hours. And it has made me a better writer. And it has taken away my very critical self-monitor. Because I know I have to get this to James. And so I can let it go. Where with short stories and novels, I'm a hard time letting go.
Wow. I guess I probably would look even further because James invited me to be part of the last story. And when I set out to accomplish this, I'm trying not to make it very quickly to myself, but I'm not sure to what extent I've been successful at it. The thing is, I believe. Yes, my state is called being right up to the deadline. I've never had a big deadline in my life before. I think I'm good. And I've been there. Thank you really good. I'm sorry.
Now, Melody is being modest. Look, even in a column that she wrote about her ass, she was able to put a mysterious twist in it. It was the case of the missing ass.
I lost mine. The people who are in the world want you to have a sense of community with each other, but you feel like you develop a sense of community with their regular readers. And kind of a companion question is the connection to your short-term readers.
Correct.
Well, it's not just been short story readers. A lot of writers. We've had all sorts of really good visitors. Other bloggers. Sarah Weinman regularly stops by our blog, and she's probably the goddess of mystery blogging. And there's a lot of short story writers who have stopped by, and there definitely is a sense of community that's developed.
My favorite comments are the ones that end, I have to read that when we recommend a story or point out a certain thing. And that's, like I said, the primary purpose of the blog. And that does happen a lot. Each one of us, I think, brings different things to the table. And some of us bring different people in. One person who isn't here today, Deborah Elliott Upton, is a regular on the blog. She lives in Amarillo, Texas. And she's a motivational speaker and also teaches marketing and selling short stories. And she's got fans in Texas from one end to the other. And they are very vocal when they go online. Now, they knew about her already, but they didn't know about the rest of us. But they've entered into the dialogue as well. So it's been good for us and for them. And I think there's very much a community about Criminal Brief.
Yeah, for those of you who are not familiar with it, you know, after the blog, you are welcome to comment, and sometimes a raging conversation happens where you have the blog, and then somebody has something, a large comment about that, and then somebody comments on the comment, and it goes around and around, and it gets to be a very fascinating dialogue, and it's, what, www.criminalbrief.com? I mean, that's fairly simple.
So,
no
WWE. Yeah,
it doesn't matter.
What?
We've also reached out to the broader community. We don't just feel that we compete with other blogs. In fact, we talk about and write constantly. Women of Mystery.net is another one that we mentioned. There's many others. And we've had guests, Dale Andrews, who was nominated for last night, and you know, we've talked with Jerry back there. You know, we talk about it and communicate and recommend other books and other writers, and it's not just about ourselves. You know, we have big egos, but it's not competition, it's community.
You know, it's a cliche, but writing is a lonely business. And something about being on the blog. Now, these are some of us have just met for the first time, and I think somehow through our writing we got to know each other. I think I was very surprised by, you know, I knew Lee was going to be doing. I mean, this is how wonderful writing is, because Lee captures himself in his writing, and I do, all of us. And so we were in that. I felt this camaraderie, even though we didn't know each other. We were.
We're smart.
But Lonnie wins. There's a compliment. So it's helpful that way, that these are friends now, but we met each other through our work. James keeps telling me how many hits we get. Sounds like the mafia. I don't know. But I love it.
Yeah, I think
it
would almost be impossible for us not to. We have to know each other pretty well. But I read each other's opinions every week. And then there's the comments that I've forwarded, and we know each other several times. And I feel like I know some of these folks up here, know those, some of the people back home. I am worried about some of these folks.
Is there any kind of questions from the audience?
Let me ask the questions that I thought this panel was going to be about. I just three basic questions.
Okay.
How many markets are there for mystery short stories in the U.S. that pay over 5 cents a word that are between the mouth for Hitchcock? Two, are there any online outlets for mystery short stories that pay real money? And three, have you guys sold short fiction to unusual publications that either don't normally publish short fiction or don't normally publish mystery?
I did, if you don't mind me interrupting here. I did a deal with a newspaper in upstate New York. I need your help. Where was that?
Some New York.
Back on the net. And I wanted an ad in their paper. The paper actually covered several little towns in upstate. So I made a deal with them. I took a long short story of mine, cut it into 5 pieces, which I didn't even know if it would work, but it did. It's a weekly paper, and in exchange, every week that they publish that section of story, they, of course, did a little bio of me and caught the reader up on where they were in the story, and they had a color ad for my book, okay? Because my book was about stand-up comedians and the Catskills, and so I thought that area would be a really good market. And so we bartered, and that's what I did too. And so I would consider that kind of unusual, because this is a newspaper, and they had never published fiction before, but the editor thought that was kind of a cool idea, so why not? And I got a full-color ad for it. I would.
Did they come to you, or did you approach them with that idea?
I don't remember, but it was, I did a reading up there, and I think it was one thing, I don't know, I'm not quite sure, it's been a while. They approached me? Okay.
There's only so much you can tell. You stop going into the why don't you start using it's just not getting into the chat every month.
I have no idea what you're talking about. However, let me go back to the earlier questions here. First of all, markets other than Ellery Queen and Hitchcock that are over 5 cents a word. I think Andrew Belly pays 5 cents a word or more in The Strand. As far as I know, that's the only other magazine. The other major markets for short stories are anthologies. And generally, those are themed, and they are, in order to get a story in, you usually have to know the editor and be invited to participate. In some instances, there are anthologies that solicit open submissions in order to fill out the rest of the, for example, Mystery Writers of America every year has an anthology that they open up to members to submit for competition to have their stories sold, and then they get paid, I think, somewhere around 8 cents a word for the stories that go into that. So those were the markets. Are. Short stories, unless you're at Hope, short stories are not a way to make a living. It's you do it for the love of the art.
Online,
I'm not a big believer in online publications of short stories. There are a number of different sites that publish them. Most of them have gotten financially are not very viable. Probably the best known of them is Hard Luck Stories. Which was which is now a ceased publishing new fiction. So it's very difficult. The other thing about doing things online is, since there's such general access to anything that goes online, is the standards of stories that get published online are generally very low. But you don't have the same kind of bottleneck process to judge quality on the internet that you have in print. So it's very difficult to know what's good and what isn't when something appears online.
And I think Orchard Press Mysteries, as far as online mystery publications, I think they're back in business now. And you mentioned unusual places to publish stories, one of my stories, maybe Star Magazine. I don't want to put that in a couple letters, but I'm writing there with, baby's father was a three-headed paper. Well, actually, at that point, I had an agent for short fiction, and I think he tried Star because he needed folks there. Was the way that worked out. But there are all kind of markets. Not many of them are web-based markets, but I had a story in a famous literary journal at one point, so you can publish stories in a lot of different places.
Networking is really crucial to a lot of this. You know, like you're here. You're going to meet a lot of people and talk to them and stuff. That's a really good start.
Do any of you prefer a particular voice? I think Melody mentioned Chris Bruce for the show sometimes, or do you all try different voices depending on your
role? I love to try everything. I just love to try everything. You know? Maybe you may not ever see it in print, but. Yeah.
I write two primary series, the 18th century one that I alluded to earlier, and also I do a contemporary PI series. The 18th century, the narrative is all in the third person, because in order to do it in the first person, the whole thing would have to be written in an 18th century style. So that way, I'm able to keep the dialogue in an 18th century style, but use a contemporary voice for the narration. On the other hand, the hard-boiled series is all told in the first person, particularly because it takes place in Los Angeles, and it's going to be compared to Chandler anyway. So the idea, so what I'm doing there is I'm following the tradition of the first-person narrative of private eye detection. I think every writer will choose the voice according to the purpose that serves in the story. And that's the primary consideration when you choose voices, whether or not it serves what you're trying to say best.
I think for me, and again, it's probably from my acting, but I tend to write always in the first person, even though they can be varying characters. So it's all like taking on a character for me. And the actors in me can take this voice and become that person. And so, yeah, that's what I do.
Any other questions? Is there a benchmark or something that goes on in your process where you decide this is truly a subject that merits a short story versus a longer format? I know we're here to talk about short stories, but as you're writing and creating your novels as well, what factors do you decide on the length? Is it in the beginning or later in the process to make that sense?
So when you make a decision between when you're writing, it's something maybe more than a short story or a novel that really should be a short story.
I didn't understand Mr. O'Keefe's question originally. I think it seems to hinge upon the value that you can get with your wording, with the subject, that some subjects just do not merit an entire book. And contrarily, some subjects, it's very difficult to pack into 5,000 or 10,000 words.
I think it's a matter of artistic temperament more than anything else. You know, novelists are constantly telling me that, oh, you're a short story writer. I can't write short stories. Well, you know what? I have trouble writing novels. But to me, the short story is the natural form for telling the story. You know, there are 4 Sherlock Holmes novels and 66 Sherlock Holmes short stories. That's because Conan Doyle was much more comfortable with the short story than he was with the novel. And that is very much the way I feel. I have an idea. I can map it out in my head and know how long it's going to take to write it. But stretching it out to 70,000 words intimidates the hell out of me.
Any more questions?
First of all, you must have an inner critic, okay? But not a diabolical one, you know. So you need to say to this inner critic, okay, I'm in charge. Let me get the work on the paper. I know it's going to be bad. All first drafts are. Maybe even the third or fourth draft is still going to be bad. But pretty soon it's going to be good. A flattery artist is a wonderful thing. A writer has to allow herself or himself to be stupid. And if you can't allow yourself to be stupid, which means I don't know what the hell I'm writing about, then you're not going to get to that, to the end of it. And, I think other people call it discovery, exploration, all those words. But it's tough, because what you have in your head, and then what comes out on paper, is not the same thing. And it's the same for everybody, whether you're a professional or not a professional. And you just have to, the sculptors, what's that word? Help me. Works with a hunk of clay. We have to make that hunk of clay. And then we have to mold it and form it into a short story. And you have to find yourself to get to all the dirty work. And that's where you pull out your critical monitor until the end, where you can really look at this and say, wow, this is good, this isn't.
Any more questions?
I just wanted to add one thing. T.S. Eliot said that a book is never finished, it is simply abandoned. And what he meant by that was is that you work on something until you're afraid if you do anything more to it, you'll hurt it. And I think that's essentially what happens with any kind of writing, is that you work on it until you're afraid that if you do more, any more to it, it won't help it. And that's when you stop.
I've just started writing short stories, and I understand writing novels that you can go 4, 5, 6, 7 drafts before you get something that you want to show to somebody. But in short stories, do you end up writing only 2 or 3 drafts, or are you going 8, 10? Or does it depend on the story?
It depends.
Is it all funny?
It depends how, I have short stories that just sort of fell out, in a sort of way that I was, oh God, I got it, I do these now. And then the next one took me, 20 drafts. So it depends.
I think, if you've ever really written a story, because tell me they have to, not secretly, not to go through it, just 20 drafts.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, God, yeah. I mean, something I have in the front goes at the end. Just rip it to shreds, and it's like re-quilting.
Yes.
Question about it. We're looking for stories. What's the first?
The first thing I look for, and there's a bunch of different things, and I think sometimes. Some of the things that we mentioned early on is the evocativeness, the dialogue, how crisp and real the dialogue feels to me. It's not always the surprise of it. Sometimes it's just sort of how I begin and
since we're getting the right. I probably be weird looking in different ways than other people, but I think those are the things when I read a story that I really like, the description is everything is kind of come together, so I really sort of felt in a place in that story at that time.
There's also another resource in the room, which is she's a pretty girl in the Payan family, and she was born a Hillary Queen, and you know, she should be a good resource.
She's the one that's going to be running screaming out of the room.
I'm curious, on Criminal Brief, are there particular authors or stories that tend to come up a lot as more examples that you like to give people or that seem to provoke a lot of discussion, the blog favorites that you want?
Somerset Maugham keeps coming up.
Okay.
That's true, but it's weird. I mean, I just wrote a whole poem on Ashton's the secret spine. And but even besides that, he doesn't just keep popping up. And it's just, I find it very interesting because you think Raymond Chandler, who would think, you know, just mystery writers, but often talks to Mom all the time.
Yeah, Mom does pop up. Chandler and Conan Doyle pop up a lot too, though. You have to admit. But I think the thing about when Doris won the Nobel Prize, Melody and I had a fight over it on the internet. She was pro, I was con. But getting back to Mom, the wonderful thing about Mom is that he's such a model for writing short stories in any kind of frame that he's one of those guys like Anton Chekhov or O. Henry, who also pops up quite a bit, who is just a model writer when it comes to writing short stories. And his voice is much more contemporary than Chekhov's or O. Henry's, and I think that's another reason why we all admire him so much.
I just want to I read somewhere that more films based on longer stories than any other one.
That's true. More films are based on short stories than the novels, you're saying?
Oh, no, I thought stories and novels by
One of my favorites is the letter of Betty Davis. She comes down on the stairs and shoots people. Nobody's better than her.
Actually, I didn't hear part of your question, so the thing is, short stories are ideally made for adaptation to film. And Stuart Kaminsky, who was for many years professor of film at Northwestern and has written just nobody knows how many television shows and movie scripts, things like that. So he knows, and he said short story is really what filmmakers look for even now. I mean, even though things are morphing into more technologically advanced time, still, short story is better. And books are great, but you know you have to chop up the books in little pieces. So, I mean, look at Strangers on a Train, you know, Patricia Highsmith. And that's a great movie.
I think it's actually run out of time. Can I take one more question?
One more question.
Yeah. Well, my mind would be, it's not the thing that short stories are supposed to say. But yes, you have to read so much out for the world. Yeah. Whereas the short story, just with a
little time, that's not enough. Is it the short story? With a novel, you have a little bit more to work with. You know what it is? I think short stories, they can grab a hold of the core of the idea. And then they don't have that much else to destroy. So, you know, with novels, it's, you know, it's critical because they're going to destroy it.
But it does have to be visual. Very visual is the key to that.
I think we might have a time. Which is in
Okay.
Thank you very much.